Hello there, and welcome to the very first episode of Kaya's Corner. I'm your host, Kaya, and I just want to say a quick thank you so much to anyone who is listening to and supporting this podcast. Let's dive right in. And that's why podcasts are free. Anyway, today I want to talk about this amazing book. It's really special to me. It's called A Million Little Pieces. It was published in 2003, and it was written by a man named James Frye. I just want to read a little bit of this book for you, and then talk a little bit about why I think everybody should read it. I was first introduced to A Million Little Pieces in my high school creative writing class. Eventually, I became an assistant teacher, and I taught about that book. And after doing some research and watching some of the interviews he did, I decided I really needed to read it. So I bought a copy and I read it nonstop while I was in college for like a month straight. Walking to class, while I was in class, eating lunch, I read it all the time. I'm telling you, this book shook my soul. I felt pain and way too many emotions and anxiety. I could not put this book down. And when I finished it, I read it again. I do want to take a minute to say that this book is a really explicit one. And by that, I don't just mean curse words. It's got a lot of violent imagery, and it's a little rough. You just need to prepare yourself before you read it. It shows you the realistic side of drug and alcohol abuse. It talks about forbidden love and the true meaning of the word comeuppance. A Million Little Pieces is a journey alongside a broken man who learns how to love and how to live again with the help of a drug treatment center. So without further ado, A Million Little Pieces by James Frye. I don't like goodbyes. You gotta say 'em, though. No, you don't. I stand, and I take my tray, and I get back in line, and I get more food, and I get more napkins, and I make my way toward an empty table in the corner, and I sit down, and I eat my food. I eat slower this time. With each bite I take, I feel my stomach expanding. It is an awful, uncomfortable feeling, but I can't stop. I take bite after bite. I feel worse and worse. I look at the food and I don't want any more, but it doesn't matter. I take bite after bite. I feel worse and worse. Get something. Fill me. That is all that matters. Fill me. I finish the plate and I stand and I walk slowly, slowly, slowly across the dining room, and I put my tray on the conveyor belt to the dishwasher. When I turn around, Lily is standing in front of me. Although I saw her a little while ago, I didn't really see her. And although I have met her twice before, I have never really looked at her. She has long black hair to the middle of her chest, and she has blue eyes. Not ice blue, water blue. Deep, clean water blue. She is pale white, pale, pale, pale white. And her lips are thick and blood red, though she is not wearing lipstick. Her jeans are old and worn, and her black sweater is old and worn, and her combat boots are old and worn, and everything is too big for her body, which is small and thin. She is holding a tray and smiling. Her teeth are straight and white, and they are straight in a way that came without braces, and white in a way that has nothing to do with toothpaste. I smile back. She speaks. You have teeth?
Yeah.
They look nice.
Thanks.
You doing all right?
Not even close.
You?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Good. I step around her and I walk away.
I know she is watching me, but I don't look back. I make my way through the halls, and I go to the lecture hall, and I find a seat among the men of my unit, and I sit down. Leonard sits next to me, and I get up, and I move so that there is a seat between us. He looks at me, and he laughs. I ignore him. The lecture starts. It is about letting go and letting God. The man giving the lecture has been sober for a decade. Whenever he is troubled or something is going wrong in his life, he turns it over to God and goes to an AA meeting. God does with it what he will, resolving it for better or for worse, and the man doesn't worry about it or try to control it. He just waits and trusts, waits and goes to meetings, waits and assumes whatever happens is what is supposed to happen. When he talks of God and of his trust in his mighty male God, his eyes glaze over. It is a glaze I know, and have seen many times before, usually when somebody is fucked out of their skull on strong, hard drugs. His God has become his drug, and he is high, high as a kite, and he rants and raves, paces back and forth, God this and God that, blah, blah, blah. If I was closer to him, or if I could get at him, I would punch him in the mouth just to make him shut up. He finishes, and everybody is impressed, and everyone claps. I get up, and I leave. When I get outside the door, Ken is waiting for me. Hi, James.
Hi.
Could you come with me for a little while?
Why?
Your test results have come back, and Dr. Baker wants to speak with you.
Okay.
We walk back through the light of the halls, and it makes me uncomfortable. And Ken tries to make small talk, and I ignore him. I ignore him because my need to get fucked up is growing, and it is screaming at me, and it is all I can think about, and all I can concentrate on. I would kill for a drink right now. Kill, drink, kill, drink, kill. We walk into the medical unit, and Ken takes me to the waiting room, and he tells me to wait. He leaves, and I smoke a cigarette, and I watch television. The cigarette tastes good, and it burns my throat and my lungs, and though it is the lowest and weakest drug that I am addicted to, it is still a drug, and it feels fucking good. I don't care what it's doing to me, it feels fucking good. There is a coffee machine in the corner, and I get up and I get myself a cup. I pour sugar into it to the point of saturation, and I take a sip, and it is hot, and it hurts to drink it, and I like it. My heart speeds up almost immediately, and though it doesn't speed up like it normally does, and though I am not addicted to coffee, it is still a drug, and it feels good. It feels so good. Ken comes back to the room, and he says the doctor is ready, and I stand, and he leads me through the medical unit to a small, clean, white examination room. There are three chairs and a window and a set of shiny steel shelves with instruments on them and an examination table against one of the walls and an x-ray viewing machine hanging near the door. Dr. Baker is sitting in one of the chairs with a file. He stands when we enter.
Hi, James.
He offers his hand. I shake it.
Hello, Dr. Baker.
We sit.
Can I see your teeth?
I smile. They look good. Dr. Stevens said you were very brave. Dr. Stevens was good to me. Thank him for me next time you speak to him.
I will.
Now tell me why I'm here.
Dr. Baker opens his file.
I have the results from the test we took a few days ago.
How bad is it?
He looks at the file. He takes a deep breath. He leans back in his chair, and he looks at me, and he speaks. You have done significant damage to your nose, your throat, your lungs, your stomach, your bladder, your kidneys, your liver, and your heart. I have never seen so much and such extensive damage in someone so young. We would need to do more tests to know the specific extent of it, and if you want them done, we can facilitate that. But from what I have here, I know a few important things. The first is that you are lucky to be alive. The second is that if you ever have another drink or use any type of hard drug again, there is a good chance that you will die. The third is that if you start drinking or using drugs regularly again, you will be dead within a few days. Your body has suffered from a pattern of such profound and prolonged abuse that it will not hold up anymore. Ken is staring at me. Dr. Baker is staring at me. I look past him and out the window where the storm is still raging. I finally know with absolute certainty what I have suspected for a long time. I am almost dead. It's a happy fucking day. Dr. Baker speaks. This is not a joking matter, James. I look at him. I know it's not. But what the fuck am I supposed to say? I have received my sentence. Ken speaks. What's that mean? What do you think it means? We're here to help you, James. We're here to help you get better and help you learn how to stop killing yourself. If you do what we tell you to do and you follow the program we prescribe, you will live a long and happy life. I have received my sentence. It doesn't have to be carried out. Just trust us. I look at Dr. Baker. You got anything else to say to me? I hope you'll trust us. I hope you'll give us a chance to help you, and I hope to God you're here tomorrow. I stare at him. His eyes are thick and wet and breaking. He is obviously sad and obviously disappointed. I'm tired of making people sad, and I'm tired of disappointing them, and I'm tired of seeing them break. I have seen this too many times. He will be the last. I appreciate your time and your efforts, both of you. Thank you. I stand and I open the door, and I walk out of the room, and I shut the door behind me, and I head back to my room. Although I have just been told that further use of alcohol and drugs is going to kill me, and kill me soon, what I want right now is a nice strong drink and a blast of rock. I want them badly. Get something. I want them so badly. Fill me. I would kill for them. Get something. Kill for them. Fill me. I am completely fucked. All around me, people are going about their day. Patients are going to counseling and to therapy. Doctors and therapists are giving them whatever they need. People are either getting help or giving help, and they're all doing it willingly. Their bodies are recovering, and their minds are recovering, and they are rebuilding their lives, and they are following the program, and they're trusting in the program. They have turned themselves over, and they believe. And whether it works or not in the long run doesn't matter. For now, they believe. I don't know how they're doing it. I get to my room and I see that someone has retrieved the Bible and the big book that I threw out the window and placed them back on my bed. They are soggy and wet, the pages swollen, the covers warped. The fact that they are back and that someone has brought them back makes me angry. I pick them up and I carry them to the bathroom and I stuff them in the garbage can beneath the used razors, the brown Q-tips, and the dirty snot rags. If I could and if my body would cooperate, I would stuff them into a toilet and I would shit on them. I walk back to my bed and I lie down and I close my eyes, and the finality of Dr. Baker's words start to sink in. And the words clear my mind and kill my urges and slow my heart. I have received my sentence. A few days of regular drug and alcohol abuse is going to kill me. I will be dead, gone, no more. I will cease to exist in any way, shape, or form. I will meet the blackness, and the blackness will be eternal. Somehow I always knew I would meet my end this way. Somehow I always knew that I would kill myself with drugs and alcohol. I knew each time I took a drink. I knew each time I snorted a line. I knew each time I hit a pipe or sniffed a tube or took a pill. It is nobody's fault but my own. I knew each and every time. I could never stop.
I can imagine my obituary. The truth of my existence will be removed and replaced with imagined good. The reality of how I lived will be avoided and changed, and phrases will be dropped in like beloved son, loving brother, reliable friend, hard-working student. People will change their view of me from reckless fuck-up to helpless martyr, from dangerous fool to sad victim, from addicted asshole to unfortunate child. They will say things like, "My God, what a waste. Oh, what he could have been. He had so much going for him. What happened?" And it will be false. Every single word of it will be false. Now, wasn't that a journey? That book is deep and interesting. And it makes me a little uncomfortable. I want to talk a little bit about the drama surrounding this book and why I think it's so interesting. So originally this book was released as a memoir, but it wasn't until after Oprah added it to her book club that James Frey was called out. There's a section of the book that talks about him getting a root canal without any sort of anesthesia or pain medicine afterwards. And the cool part about that part of the book is that it's written in a very descriptive and realistic way. He paints his words with agony, and the way he writes it makes me a little uneasy. Now, the kind of disappointing part is that was all a lie. The whole root canal ordeal was a lie. And Oprah's reaction was not a nice one when she found that out. She brought James Frey out on her show for a second time and told him off in front of her entire audience. She called him a liar. She said that he had broken her heart. Her reaction was a harsh one that she later apologized to him and her audience for, but I think I would have reacted in the same way, in the heat of the moment. James Frey said he fabricated more than one part of this book, and he never intended to release it as a memoir, and that was the doing of his publisher. He then had the genre of his book changed to a semi-fictional novel. Nowadays, if you Google the genre of this book, it's going to tell you it's a piece of misery literature. My personal opinion is that the semi-fictional novel is the perfect genre for a book like this. What do you think? I can't believe this is already the end. Thanks so much again for listening and supporting me. Don't forget to share this podcast with your friends and tell them all about A Million Little Pieces by James Frey. Don't forget to follow us so you can know when new podcasts come out. Until next time, see you later.